Hello, and welcome to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach, and today we are continuing our look at the book of Genesis. So last week we looked at Genesis chapter 27. We were going through the deception of Isaac by his son Jacob, his wife, of course, Rebecca, and all of these that decided that they wanted to try to take God's will into their own hands and caused a lot of pain and misery in their lives as a result of that. And there's going to be some of that that comes into play today in chapter 28 because we're going to be looking at the consequences and the foolishness of men when it comes to understanding God and his purposes. And so at the beginning of chapter 28, we're kind of writing off of what happened. If you remember correctly, of course, Esau got very, very angry at what Jacob had done and talks about the fact that when his father is dead, he is going to kill Jacob to take back his birthright. And so his mother, of course, says, No, we're not going to do that. And instead, I'm going to send him to my family's land, Abraham's ancestral land, to find himself a wife. And of course, this was not only for Jacob to find a wife, but also as a way to give Esau some time to cool down, basically. And so what ends up happening at the beginning of chapter 28 is it says, "And Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said unto him, Thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padan Aram, the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, and take thee a wife from thence of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brother. And God Almighty bless thee, and make thee fruitful, and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people, and give thee the blessing of Abraham to thee, and to thy seed with thee, that thou mayest inherit the land wherein thou art a stranger, which God gave unto Abraham. And Isaac sent away Jacob, and he went to Padan Aram unto Laban, son of Bethuel the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob's and Esau's mother." So at the end of this, Rebecca, of course, hatches this scheme to get Jacob away from Esau, convinces Isaac to now approach Jacob and say, "Okay, look, we're sending you to your uncle's house, basically. There you're going to get a wife, and once you have gotten your wife, you will return to the land that God has fulfilled for you." By this point, Isaac is not as adamantly in protest against Jacob having the blessing as he had been, all throughout this entire narrative of Scripture. Obviously, him and Esau had hatched their own little plan to get this land and to get the blessing to Esau. And of course, that did not end up happening. But by this point, Isaac had realized, like he realized in the last chapter, that he could not thwart the will of God and that he was going to be the one to carry on the family name. And so he sends Jacob on his way. What's sad about this whole situation is that what's going on here in chapter 28 is a spillover from what was going on in chapter 27. Here we see God's will is not only fulfilled, but is now being recognized by all of the family members, except for, of course, Esau, who we're going to see in a minute, is doing all he can to convince his father that he should have the blessing instead. But anyway, so already, what we're seeing here in chapter 28 is this unnecessary consequence for sin. And what I mean by unnecessary is that in the sense that the sin itself was completely unnecessary. What God said would come to pass was going to come to pass regardless of what anyone tried to do. And I had a few interesting questions, you know, this week from people of, well, I mean, you know, what, well, how would that be the case? He fully intended to bless Esau. Friends, there's been so many times in the Bible that men have been about to do something that God has intervened. When Abraham was preparing to kill his son Isaac, God intervened with an angel. When Lot and his family were in Sodom and Gomorrah, God intervened with sending two angels to rescue that particular family. There's always, always, always a chance for God to do something of his own free will that you and I would never expect. I firmly believe that if Jacob and Rebecca had left things alone for God to handle on his own, none of this would have ever had to be. But now we see a family that's completely divided. The brothers hate each other. The husband and wife's relationship's never really going to be the same. The mother, of course, is never going to see one of her sons again. All because we did not want to acknowledge the will of God, which is being carried out right here. Jacob has received the birthright. And Isaac sends him away. Well, in the meantime, as I said, there is one family member who has not accepted this as true. One family member who is still trying to go against the will of God. And like I said, this is about the consequences of sin and the foolishness of men throughout this entire chapter. It says, when Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take him a wife from thence, and that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge, saying, thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. And then Jacob obeyed his father and his mother and was gone to Padan Aram. And Esau, seeing that the daughters of Canaan pleased not Isaac his father, then went Esau unto Ishmael and took unto the wives which he had Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife. Esau, unwilling to accept God's decision, decides that maybe the issue with his dad not blessing him is because of his already carried out sins of marrying Canaanite women. But, you know, not just woman, but women. And he decides that, well, I guess if dad doesn't like those girls, which he already knew dad didn't like those girls, that he was going to go to Ishmael and marry, I'm having a hard time today, and marry one of his daughters. Now, why Esau thought that this would fix anything, would make him more acceptable, would make things right between him and his father, is completely beyond my understanding. Other than that, it's just plain ignorance, or maybe just plain stupidity, that he ends up thinking this. See, we've already seen at the beginning of chapter 28 that there's these unnecessary consequences that are brought about because of the sinful decision that Isaac and Jacob and Rebecca and Esau all made in chapter 27. And now the family is being split apart. And instead of everybody getting on board, being willing to accept God's will, being willing to realize that all of this came about because they decided that they were going to try to do things themselves, Esau here goes right out and makes the situation even more worse. He, instead of chasing after Canaanite women, now marries the descendants of Ishmael, who we know are not exactly good, law-abiding, God-fearing people. And all of this is in an attempt to thwart God's will. He thinks that if he goes and marries one of these girls, that his dad's going to change his opinion and give him the blessing that God had already promised Jacob long before he was ever born. And so when we're looking at this chapter, I've already told all of you that the main point of this chapter is the foolishness of men. Firstly, our foolishness in not being willing to accept God's decision. here everybody has figured out that God's will has gotten done regardless of what everybody else wanted, except for Esau, who now takes a situation that is bad and turns it into a worse situation by marrying yet another woman. However, it's not just Esau who has not learned his lesson. It's also Jacob. Look at what happens here. It says, "And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down to that place to sleep." So Jacob is off. He's traveling to Paddan Aram's, going to go stay with his uncle for a while and hopefully come back with a wife. That's what he was charged with doing. And he arrives here at Beersheba, which has played a very pretty prominent role even up to this point in a lot of the things that are going on in the Old Testament. And as he gets there, sun's going down. He's traveling alone. It's not very wise to travel alone at night. Would be considered wise to travel alone during the day in these days and the days and times in which he was in, and with wilderness and robberies and animals and things of this nature. And so he decides to stop for the night. He gets him a nice little grouping of rocks to use as pillows. And he lays down and goes to sleep. It says, "And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set upon the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of." So God comes to Jacob in a dream. And what happens in this dream is very amazing, not only for us biblically, because, you know, we as New Testament believers know that this symbolizes, of course, the connection and the personal relationship that God has with his creation, and that he is nearer than we think is the idea. Then there's this ladder that is connecting heaven and the earth. And of course, we know that ladder to be Jesus Christ. There aren't many ways to God, but there is but one way to God. But what also is going on here with these angels ascending and descending is that it showed Jacob that God plays an active role in everyday life. One of the foolish things that we as men tend to believe is that God kind of just sits back and lets the clock turn. And that is not at all true. God is always actively at work in our lives. God is always aware of what is going on in our lives. And there is always something going on in the spiritual realm around us that we are too dense to realize is even going on 99.9% of the time. And so here Jacob not only witnesses this picture of God's relationship and what would eventually be a prophecy pointing to Christ, but he also receives the covenant promise from God himself. You know, when you were a kid and your parents would talk about, you know, maybe so-and-so from back in the day, you know, his buddy of your dad, whatever, you had this envisioning of who this guy was, or, you know, or what he did, any kind of person that you would idolize, is how I would put it, okay, that your parents would tell you about, but you never met him, never met him, never met him. There comes a time that you start to what? Well, you start to doubt, don't you? You start to doubt the legitimacy of maybe this person or this event, or, you know, maybe the magnitude of what it is that they're saying. But then when it finally happens to you, it's a mind-blowing experience, isn't it? I can only imagine Jacob growing up in the household of Isaac, all right? Isaac, who has had God come and talk to him. Isaac, who has had God appear in dreams. Isaac, who is the son of Abraham, the man who literally walked with God at one point. You know, when you're looking at Jacob's upbringing, I've always sat here and gotten to this verse thinking about the fact that as he received that blessing, I don't think he fully understood just what he had. He had not had this connection with God yet. He had not had this relationship formed with God where he had an intimate knowledge of God, especially in the way that Isaac and Abraham knew of God. But here he is. He's received the blessing. He's dreaming, and he dreams of this magnificent display that has so much in it that we could talk for quite a while of what was going on with this dream and what it symbolizes. But then to have the actual covenant God of his father speak to him and say, "This is the promise that I made to Abraham and I made to your Isaac, and it is the promise that I am making to you, that I will bring you back into this land. I will set you up. Your seed shall bless all of the earth." But even more than that, he says, "And behold, I am with thee." God looks at Jacob despite all the dumb things that he has just recently done. Despite the lack of character that he has at this point, and despite the fact that I know that God knew what his reaction was going to be, where we're going to look at the very, very dumb thing that he does and says following this dream, and despite God knowing all of that about Jacob, he had chosen Jacob, and he was determined to make sure Jacob knew that no matter what, he was always going to be there helping along the way. Guys, despite who we are, one of the foolish things that we realize, because sometimes we get this idea that, well, we're so bad, God can't do anything with us, which is what I call humble arrogance. And then there's sometimes we get regular arrogance, which is that God does what he does for us because of how good we are. When in all reality, God does things for us despite who we are. With Jacob, there was absolutely nothing about this man that made him worthy of God or of God being with him and guiding him and leading him. But despite all of those things, he tells Jacob, "I am going to be with you. I am going to take care of you, and I will bring you back home again." Now, after hearing something as amazing as this dream, I would hope that even, speaking even for myself, that my reaction would be that of humility and that of understanding of what I had just saw and heard, that my reaction would be to honor and worship God for what I did, maybe grasp the whole picture. But look at what happens with Jacob. It says, "And Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, 'Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not.'" So he starts out good here, right? He understands the presence of God is with him. He understands that he's completely unaware. Foolishly, we are unaware of the fact that God is much more near than we think he is on a regular basis. But then it says, "And he was afraid and said, 'How dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven.'" Jacob starts out going, "God was here, and I didn't even realize that God was that close." And that we're just like that in this life. We tend to forget that God is right there 24/7, 365 days, okay? But then Jacob takes and places God in a box, essentially. God's just told him, "Wherever you go, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to keep you. I'm going to take care of you." Meaning that, "Jacob, I am in control of everything. Everywhere you go, I will be. There is never a time you are out of my presence." And here Jacob completely misses it. He goes, oh, well, this must be God's house, and this must be the gate of heaven. He is completely ignorant to the promise that God has made him. He said, well, you know, maybe he just had a little oopsie there. No, he didn't just have a little oopsie, because then look what he continues to say. It says, and Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was called Luz at the first. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. Jacob wakes up, he builds an altar, and he tries to bargain with God. God had already told him in the dream, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to take care of you. All I need you to do is obey. All I need you to do is do what your fathers have told you to do. If you'll do that, everything else will be fine. And instead, Jacob gets up in his human foolishness and ignorance and tries to do what Jacob does best, and that is bargain with God Almighty. God, if you will take care of me, if you'll feed me, if you'll clothe me, if you'll bless me, then I'll let you be my God. Do you know the absolute foolishness of even thinking that you and I have the capabilities to bargain with the creator of the world? Have you ever taken the time to really wrap your mind around the level of arrogance that exists, not just in humans as a whole, but even in myself and in any of you that are listening? Because I know that if I have done this, then you have certainly done this, where we have tried to bargain with God. And it's like coming to a man that holds all the cards and then trying to weasel your way into making him give you what you want. He's come to Jacob and given him a promise of magnitude that Jacob is unworthy of, that any of us would have been unworthy of. And in all of that foolishness, Jacob gets up and tries to bargain with God as to whether or not he'll let God be the leader of his life. And it hinges on whether or not he thinks God meets his standards of living, that he'll have the life that he deems that he should have. And what is absolutely amazing about this is that this is a behavior that God's people deal with every single day still. We will bargain with God on church attendance. We'll bargain with God on tithing. We'll bargain with God on sin and what we, you know, should be able to get away with and what we should not be able to get away with. We'll try to bargain with God on prayer and studying or what we're doing in our day-to-day personal lives. Friends, there's no bargaining with God. And thank heavens for all of us that even when we do or say something as foolish as what Jacob has just said, God does not forsake us for it. Because as soon as he says all this, it says, and this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee. He turns to God and says, and if you'll do all of this, this can be your house, and I give you money. And even when he does that, nowhere in here do you see where God takes away what he said. And God would have been completely within the just and righteousness of himself to have said, actually, Jacob, change in plans. But again, despite the foolishness of men, God uses this man to start to bring about the accomplishment of his work. And you say, all right, well, okay, Pastor Zach, I get it. I see where you're coming from. We do really dumb things. This entire chapter has been nothing but men doing really, really dumb things. But overall, how do I dodge that? How do I get out of doing that? Friend, the secret to not doing really, really dumb things, to being the servant that God has asked you to be, is to be obedient to His will. The only time that you and I end up in the position where Esau was, where Jacob was, is when we decide that we don't want to obey God's will, or we want to go about fulfilling God's will in our own way. And I can promise you that that's always going to end in a horrible, horrible, horrible way for you, because there's but one way to do things, and that's God's way. Here, Jacob, all of his foolishness, tries to bargain with God, and he's going to learn all about having humility when he gets to Laban's house. Esau tries to bargain with his father to get the birthright that he is unwilling to recognize that God has given it to Jacob. Again, he's going to experience that same humility over life. Isaac, who was unwilling to be obedient to God's will, has now lost one of his sons going to Padan Aram. He has a rocky relationship with his wife, and he has another son that's mad at him because he didn't get the blessing he'd been told he was going to get all of his life. Rebekah, who was unwilling to let God, to be obedient to God's will, and tried to force the situation, has a son that now hates her, and another son who she'll never see again. All we have to do to not end up where these people are in chapter 28 is be obedient and accept God's will in our lives. So, as you're going about the rest of your week, and you're kind of coming back from the 4th of July, I know many of you are probably off Monday, so now you're getting back in the groove of things today with work and whatnot. You were probably dead as a doornail Tuesday, so today you're getting back in the groove, getting ready, hopefully, to have a weekend off, maybe a little time to catch yourself up on everything that you had missed. I want you to do everything within your power this week to remind yourself of what happens when we step outside of the obedience of God's will, when we do what these people have done, and that the consequences are never worth what the price that you're going to pay. And so that has been Genesis chapter 28. We appreciate anybody new that's been on today. I can't see if there's anybody new on here today. I cannot see the screen, sorry. We've talked about this before. But if there has been anybody new on here today, glad to have you with us. Hope that you have enjoyed everything you've heard so far. You can go back and listen to all the other ones, get caught up with us. We're going to be at chapter 29 this coming Friday. And as always, get out of here and go study.